We've got plenty to worry about as we get older, diminishing physical and mental prowess, chronic health conditions, saving for retirement. That last part is the one we'll focus on in this segment. Not the saving part, but the spending that money part. You've heard plenty about financial abuse of seniors, by another name, financial exploitation of vulnerable seniors. Oregon agencies dealing with seniors have long been looking into the situation and now have a second study with some good hard numbers to get a handle on the scope of senior financial exploitation. Rebecca Fetters is the study author. She works in Oregon's Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I'm curious because OAAPI is a bit of a mouthful. What do you guys call yourselves?
We actually call ourselves OAPI.
OAPI, okay.
And I don't know if that's better or worse.
So obviously the whole point of this particular agency, though, is to look into things like adult abuse. And is it all forms, not just financial?
It is. And actually, our agency looks into abuse against people with developmental disabilities, people with mental health concerns, people with physical disabilities, people over the age of 65, and actually even some children who are living in licensed settings. And we look at all types of abuse, not just financial. We look at physical, verbal, emotional, sexual, all different types of abuse. Although, when it comes to adult protective services, which is those over the age of 65 and those who are physically disabled, financial exploitation is about 42% of our workload.
Which represents, I would think, the largest single chunk?
Yes, by far.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it happens often, but the question was how often, and you really have that nailed down a lot better now after these two studies, don't you?
We do. We did the study looking at our 2011 cases, and that certainly provided us with a good baseline. We went back and looked at our 2013 cases in this study, and the numbers had jumped pretty dramatically even in those 2 years. Our investigators are looking at well over 3,000 allegations a year throughout the state of financial exploitation.
That was in 2013, 3,000 allegations?
Right.
And how big a jump did that represent from the 2011 cases 2 years before?
I believe in 2011 we were closer to 2,600. The number has steadily climbed since 2010. I would say that the jump in 2013 actually represented the largest percentage jump.
Is there a sense that it is a case of the events happening more often, or that people are more aware of them, therefore they get reported more often?
I think it's both. I think also we have to acknowledge the fact that the service group that we serve, people over the age of 65, is growing. And so realistically, we're going to expect our numbers across all types of abuse to probably increase in the coming years just by virtue of the population shift. But I think that even with that taken into consideration, you know, I would like to think that what is driving the numbers is just studies like this and all of the national attention and just a greater awareness. And we certainly, particularly in your part of the state, in Jackson County, there has always been, I think, a high level of community outreach. You've got a financial exploitation task force. I think that reporting in general in your area is pretty sound.
How useful is it, Rebecca, to have 2 years' worth of data to work from and be able to have some side-by-side comparisons?
Oh, I think it's hugely valuable. It allows us to really start looking at trends. What is getting better? What perhaps is getting a little bit more concerning? You know, we saw some shifts and even some surprises in this year's study compared to 2011. And honestly, when we did the 2011 study, it being the first time, there were a lot of things that, you know, maybe halfway or two-thirds of the way through, I thought, oh, gosh, you know, I wish I would have been tracking this or looking at this all along, and it was kind of too late to go back and do it. This gave us an opportunity not just to look at the same data sets, but also to add some that I think are really important.
Rebecca Fetters is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's the author of a study on financial exploitation of adults in Oregon. And she works for the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation, which they call themselves OAPI. You can join us on the Exchange as we talk about the specifics of this serious subject and how it is dealt with. Join us at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, call us at 541-552-6782 or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. So, Rebecca, is there a most common circumstance or scenario? Is there like a fairly cut and dry, this is usually what happens kind of thing with senior financial exploitation?
I guess it would be really hard to say that there's a common, that there's one common scenario. There are definitely some common threads. And we know from the prior study, we know from national studies, and again this year's study, that unfortunately, the perpetrators of this type of abuse most often are family members. So that is certainly a common scenario. Another common scenario that we're seeing with even a higher level in this year's study is the use of power of attorney privileges or some other fiduciary responsibility to the victim. I think in 2011, one in every four substantiated cases involved someone with a fiduciary duty, and in this year's study, that actually rose from 25% to 33% of our perpetrators. So, you know, there's definitely some common themes, but then, as you would imagine, also a great deal of variation.
So does the report track people who live independently, in assisted care, both? I mean, does this take care of seniors in all circumstances?
Well, I should stress that Adult Protective Services does look into allegations of abuse in all settings. And we typically divide our investigations into what we consider facility investigations and then community investigations. And I think it's common to think that that has to do with where the alleged victim resides, and actually it has more to do with who the reported perpetrator is. A facility investigation is when the reported perpetrator is either an employee or a volunteer of the licensed setting, and a community allegation involves a perpetrator who is a friend or a family or someone of that sort. And what really surprised me in this year's study was that I had thought I was looking at really primarily people living in their own homes or in the community, and it turned out that over 20% of the cases were people living in facilities, but where the perpetrator was not a facility staff member. It was usually a person, often family, in the community who had kind of agreed to look after that person's assets or estate while they were living in a facility, even if that was for a short-term placement. And often those came to light because they were failing to pay the facility for services, and it turned out that that was because they were using the resident's assets and income for their own use and not the resident's.
It sounds like this presents some real obstacles to investigation and management then, because the facility doesn't necessarily know this is going on because it's certainly not one of their people. Not that they would if it were one of their people, I suppose, but the point being that that it's difficult for them to track something with a person who is not accountable to the facility.
That's true. That is true, although they certainly know if they're not getting paid.
Right.
And that's obviously the first red flag in these types of circumstances. But, you know, particularly if you're looking at a scenario where, you know, the bill is still getting paid, it makes it very difficult to know that that's happening.
This is an eminently readable report on senior financial exploitation because it's not just about cold, hard numbers, but also about individual cases with some anecdotes and some quotes and things like that. And one of the cases cited in here is a circumstance to what you just mentioned a moment ago where the facility wasn't getting paid. Now, if the savings are drained, I mean, the facility really has no choice but to give a move-out notice. Is that right?
That is often what ends up kind of getting everyone's attention, and it's their last resort. You know, at the point that they do that, I think that they would tell you that they have exhausted every other avenue available to them, and that's, you know, absolutely their last course of action to try to get the attention of the person that is supposed to be paying the bill. It also is generally the point at which, if we haven't already, our system becomes aware of the issue and, you know, tries to assist and intervene. Unfortunately, at that point, the assets may be totally depleted, and we may be looking at a scenario where Medicaid or, you know, some government-funded program has to step in and start paying for the cost of care.
Which then explains that there is a cost to society. So if anybody thinks, well, it's, you know, it's an old guy's money, I don't have to worry about it. But the fact is, there is ultimately, potentially, a cost to society.
Absolutely. I mean, there most definitely is. There is an impact to our government-funded programs, such as the scenario that we just talked about. There's less quantifiable impacts, but ones that we know exist. For example, we know that 10% of our cases involve the theft of medication. You know, that impacts the pharmacies, the pharmaceutical companies, that inevitably trickles down to the average consumer. The same could be said of another 10% of our cases, which is unauthorized use of credit cards, which often then, you know, do not get paid off, go into collections. You know, we assume that the credit card companies are then needing to pass along those expenses to other consumers. So, you know, there's actually a very wide-reaching effect to society as a whole.
We are talking about financial exploitation of seniors in Oregon with Rebecca Fetters, who just authored a study, the second of its kind, about the trends in that very act in the state of Oregon. She works for the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation. You can join us on the exchange with questions or comments. Maybe you've been in a situation like this on one end or the other. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Again, some of the most illuminating parts of this report, Rebecca, are not the hard numbers, but the anecdotes and the quotes. And in particular, you got a situation where there's a perpetrator and a victim, and sometimes neither one is really aware that they are either of those things.
That's exactly right. And, you know, when I read through all of these cases, I'm often struck by the ones that really it was just a combination of circumstances, perhaps someone acting as a rep payee or a power of attorney, and really not ever having been given the information that they need to kind of not cross that fine line of what it means to be a fiduciary. And, you know, I think a lot of good could be done by simply helping people who find themselves in those roles, educating them about what really are the do's and don'ts and the best practices, things of that sort, so that they don't kind of just run awry of that system.
Well, all right. For example, on the victim side, I mean, an example very early in the written report, a guy who knew his grandkids were taking his money, but he declined to press charges.
Yes.
Does that happen fairly often?
Very often. And, you know, people have the right to make that choice, and I think we see that very often when it is family, grandchildren, like you mentioned. You know, certainly that's a very, very difficult position for a parent or a grandparent or any other family member to be in. And I think often they want to see if they can't resolve it as a family matter, kind of keep it within their four walls and see if they can't reach some resolution. What we see is that the rate of re-abuse in this type of abuse category, financial exploitation, is higher than any other abuse type. And I think that has a lot to do with the family dynamics that often are at play.
As in, you know, this is money that Dad was going to leave to me anyway, so I get the right to do things with it?
Yeah, it's money I'm going to inherit, and I need it now. I can't really wait for the inheritance to come through. perhaps a situation where a parent or a grandparent traditionally has maybe gifted money here and there to a family member, and so it's maybe become something of an expectation. The problem there being that as that parent or grandparent ages and needs care, you know, their resources need to be prioritized to pay for their later years, for the care that they need, for the prescriptions that they need, and that they may no longer be in a position to continue supporting or gifting to their children or grandchildren.
Let's take a call. We have Avian and Mendocino on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about senior financial abuse or exploitation with Rebecca Fetters from the Oregon Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation.
Good morning. I'm listening to this program with really great interest. In 2011, my mom passed away. My brother was the successor trustee on her her will, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, he really mismanaged many things. I'm wondering, is there a statute of limitations in terms of filing charges of whatever kind they would be towards the successor trustee of how things were managed, and specifically in terms of how he really did want to save money, in his words, so we would get more inheritance, meaning that my mother wouldn't get as good of care and management. I'm wondering what the statute of limitations is.
Oh, excellent.
Since this was in 2011.
Mm-hmm. All right, good question. Thanks for that, Avian. Appreciate it.
That is a good question, and I'm going to unfortunately not be able to answer it completely straightforwardly, because that's something that differs from state to state, perhaps even from county to county. I'm not sure. I know that in the state of Oregon a couple of years ago, there was some legislature that actually increased the statute of limitation on some of these types of financial crimes, and raised it to, I want to say, 6 years here in Oregon. I think probably the very best advice I could give is to consult with someone in the elder law profession, and I can't obviously give recommendations about who that might be, but I would really encourage contacting the local bar association and asking for their lawyer referral service, and asking for someone skilled in the areas of probate law and elder law. And they most certainly could answer those questions.
Right. But, okay. So the county in which it happened too, because
correct. Yeah. But that, you know, is another very common scenario that we see, is that effort to kind of save money in order to preserve an estate or an inheritance down the road, and often that surfaces in our world in allegations of neglect, because a person is not getting the care that we need, and what we find is that it really loops back to a financial issue.
Because somebody wanted to go cheap on the care, thinking they'd have more money left over when the person being cared for dies.
Exactly.
There are some limits, then, to power of attorney, then, aren't there? I mean, because there are examples in the report you authored where people were thinking, hey, you know, I get to get some money out of doing this. But you know, one of the examples you gave was somebody kept $100,000 for himself.
Right. And that's not okay. you know, when you are power of attorney for someone, it is not your money. It is still that individual's money. And again, even if it's an individual who has had a prior history of gifting or that type of thing, it is still your duty as their fiduciary to prioritize their needs at that point in time in their life. And, you know, for most people in these cases and in these circumstances, that's care, whether it's in a facility or in their own home, having in-home caregivers come in. You know, it's just having their needs met at all times.
Rebecca, who are the mandatory reporters of financial exploitation?
There are, in the state of Oregon, 36 mandatory reporter categories, and actually come January, there's going to be a few more added, such as attorneys. I can't list them all, and we probably don't have time.
But basically, people in contact with the case. But it seems like from the report, you're also noticing people who are not required to report, but who are doing so voluntarily.
Right. I think it surprises a lot of people to find out that bankers and other folks in the financial industries are not mandatory reporters. And that's in Oregon. They are in some of our neighboring states, and that serves us well because those larger banks tend to train all of their employees as if they should be mandatory reporters. But even within Oregon, our Oregon Bankers Association has done a fantastic job working with our agency and developing a complete training toolkit for their staff to help them not just encourage them to report, but to really help them identify what the red flags are, you know, what to look out for. And they make up one of our largest reporting groups, even though they're not a mandatory reporter. In fact, for financial exploitation, 60% of our reports are made by people who are not mandated to do so. So only 40% of our reports are coming from individuals who are mandated by law to report.
That's a lot of eyes and ears out there. That's great to hear. Now, what is the average loss in a lot of these cases of financial exploitation?
It is considerable. Throughout the state, it averages close to $25,000. And in your part of the state, it's higher than that. It's closer to $27,000 per case.
Wow. In Jackson County?
Yeah.
All right.
Jackson Josephine.
All right. So Rebecca Fetters is with the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation, OAPI, and the author of a study on financial exploitation of vulnerable adults. It's quite a comprehensive study and a pretty good read at that. Rebecca, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.